On this week's 51%, the CEO of a Planned Parenthood in New York says the COVID-19 pandemic brought out more protesters.
They have gotten very aggressive since the outbreak of the COVID pandemic. They refuse to social distance appropriately.
And female film students want a more accessible path to directing. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Planned Parenthood of Greater New York, like other health services organizations, responded to the COVID-19 pandemic by relying more on telehealth. Planned Parenthood was deemed an essential service and has remained open throughout for in-person visits. New York has been reopening different regions in phases. I spoke with President and CEO Laura McQuaid about the pandemic, abortion access, and more, including protests outside its centers. The interview was recorded before protests over the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis.
Our patient volume dropped pretty substantially in the early days, and we have been building back that patient capacity through telehealth and through making sure that our centers are open and patients understand they can get care. But, you know, there's a lot of mixed messaging out there about should I get help, you know, care for something that's not COVID-related versus should I stay in my house? So we're working through that really to help people to understand they've got to get health care.
Does this look different? Are people waiting in their cars or waiting outside and being called in rather than sitting in a waiting room?
Right. It definitely looks different. So first of all, you'll notice, right, like everywhere else, you're required to have a face covering. If you don't have a face covering when you come to the center, we will provide one for you. You will notice that all of our staff, they also have gowns and protective face covering and gloves on. So it's a very different feel than, you know, back in early March. And you're also being fully screened according to the CDC guidelines, right? Temperature screening, and we're screening for all COVID-related symptoms for two reasons. First, if you have a fever and you have more than one of the other symptoms, we want to refer you immediately for healthcare related to those symptoms. And if you're not, we want you to feel comfortable, right, that you've been screened and that you can come in and feel safer in our centers. And the other option is, and so for almost all of our services, we've tried to provide at least a partial telehealth solution for people so that they could do, even for abortion care, part of the visit is done through a telehealth visit before you get to the center, so that you're limiting the time for yourself as a patient, but also for staff in the centers. And we are also, we've removed chairs from waiting rooms, so you're not seeing overcrowded waiting rooms. And we are, we're rolling out a system where we can text you. If you prefer to sit in your car and wait, you can do that. And we text you when the provider is ready to see you and you come on in. So there have definitely been the flow of the day, the flow of your visit is quite changed, and we anticipate it remaining like that for quite some time.
I wanted to go back to the telehealth kind of at the height of the pandemic or you know, fairly recently. What you saw in terms of no-touch medication abortion, was that kind of on the rise during that time? And how, you know, what did that mean?
So what it meant was that we would do, so I was talking a little bit about how we try to do some of our visits, almost all of our visits, through telehealth. So it limits your time in the center. So things that you would normally have come in for, counseling, going through the analysis of dating your pregnancy, all of that is actually now done through a telehealth visit. So when you come for the medication abortion, you're just coming to receive the medication, the instructions for taking the medication, and then the follow-up, including a urine pregnancy test. And you're actually taking it home and actually doing the entirety of the medication abortion in your home or where you choose to do it. So you're all of the aspects of registering, demographics, counseling are done remotely before patients get to the centers. You know, and one thing I did want to highlight, though, is that, you know, telehealth isn't the right platform for everybody, right? It is not. I like to say telehealth is not created equal. If you don't have sufficient technology access, do you have a computer? Do you have access to the internet? Do you have a high enough level smartphone that you can do a video visit? Right? And so we have to be aware that some patients are just never going to choose telehealth now, maybe in the future. And that's why it's so important that we know very early on whether telehealth is an option for a patient, and if not, to immediately get them an appointment in a center.
What, it's 2 to 3 months now, really, since we all realized the severity and the breadth of this virus. Did you see an uptick, though, in prescribing the medication abortion during this time?
We actually have. It's very interesting that you should ask that question. So we look at our patient volume every day. The single largest service growth area by far was medication abortion. Whether that was done partially, virtually, you know, through the video visit and then picking up the meds, or coming into the center for medication abortion medication, major uptick in that number for us, even above pre-COVID numbers.
Can you give me an idea when you say major uptick?
So we're up on those services, we're up a good 15% on medication abortion. People have always had the option to come into our centers. It's really a question of how do we get people to understand you've put healthcare off for close to 3 months now, right? We've seen this in other, you pointed out, reductions in cancer diagnoses. It makes us very nervous that people are not coming in for annual exams and therefore not getting their potential breast cancer diagnosis or, you know, an irregular pap or, you know, really being able to move forward with diagnoses on ovarian cancer and other things that are detected during annual exams. COVID is a part of our lives. You can safely come in and have a visit. It's safer to come in than to potentially put off care, or something could elevate quite quickly.
Now, when we were talking about a year ago, there was this movement in anti-abortion efforts in some states across the country. The same kind of things started happening when everything went virtual, with the states that historically are anti-abortion states were ramping up that rhetoric as well during this time. Did you feel any effect from that?
It's interesting that you should ask about that because, I mean, clearly we are in New York. We started the conversation saying we enjoy significant support from state and local elected officials across the state. And so they understand that we are essential services, but where we are seeing the uptick is in protester activity outside of our centers. They have gotten very aggressive since the outbreak of the COVID pandemic. They refuse to social distance appropriately. In many occasions, I just had an interaction with a protester on Friday afternoon. Protesters refusing to wear masks, refusing to social distance outside our centers, being very aggressive with patients and staff. So the places where we've seen it are, again, through protester activity quite aggressively. And that campaign has been very public that they are using this as an opportunity to increase their activities.
Are you seeing that protest in certain regions more than others?
Yeah, I mean, even downstate, our Manhattan center, through the entire affiliate, gets the most virulent protester activity. We know that we get protesters from around the country who come here specifically to protest in Manhattan. We've seen some uptick in Queens. We've seen an uptick out in Hempstead on Long Island, and we hadn't had the same level in the Poughkeepsie-Newburgh, which are two centers in the Mid-Hudson Valley that are open. We've seen kind of consistent engagement by protesters. And then the further you go upstate, it gets a little spottier. I think they're still bringing people in specifically to protest from out of state. Happen to also believe the people who don't believe in the pandemic, right? There's an alignment there.
But if they're not practicing what they're supposed to, I mean, this is enforceable, right? These are state mandates for social distancing, mask wearing. Have you been able to have anyone arrested or bring in law enforcement or do anything like that?
You know, we work with law enforcement, particularly downstate. We get, they come. You know, I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding between what are your First Amendment rights and then what needs to be enforced from a public health perspective. So again, law enforcement tends to go to that space if they have the right to be there to protest. And we are trying to urge them to understand this is not a protest or not protest issue. We've put markers out on sidewalks and in our parking lots so that people understand, yes, you have the constitutional right to be there, but we also have the legal right in New York State to ask you to stand 6 feet away. We are still struggling to get law enforcement to really issue summonses and enforce that in front of particularly our New York City centers, but we will continue to engage there because it is not a question of we live with protesters. It is part of the world that we live in, but that doesn't give you the right to put our staff and patients at risk during this pandemic.
Have you heard from any of sister Planned Parenthoods across the country where this is also happening?
Oh, yeah. It is an engaged and orchestrated set of circumstances across the country. And those with urban centers, those Planned Parenthoods with urban centers, where you enter right on the sidewalk, that is where you see the greatest uptick and also the greatest risk.
And then, Laura, I was reading something. This was pretty recently, actually. This was just a week or two ago. There's a watchdog group that's nonprofit that sent a letter to the FDA asking the agency to seize websites of this marketing of a procedure known as abortion pill reversal. And they know it's from three anti-abortion groups that are doing this. What any impact or any comment on that?
You know, the whole abortion reversal issue kind of cropped up about 2 or 3 years ago. And it's just so incredible that they have the ability to simply lie to people. It is not medically accurate. It is not possible. And there's not an impact on us and the provision of our services here. But that type of rhetoric has serious impact on Planned Parenthoods in other parts of the country who don't enjoy the level of support that we do here in New York State.
As you said, you were deemed at the beginning of the conversation, you were deemed an essential business, essential service. But what changed? Did you have to furlough anyone? Was anyone sick? What happened in the centers in terms of staffing and all of that kind of stuff affected by COVID?
Right. Initially in the initial weeks, we definitely had challenges. The reason that we moved to consolidate centers was for three reasons, right? Staff availability to work, the desire to be part of flattening the curve, keeping our centers open across our regions, but being part of flattening the curve. And initially, the third key piece there was on availability of PPE to make sure that we had sufficient. Since that time, PPE has stabilized. For us, we have the supplies available to us through a number of sources at the our own personal sources and then city and state resources as well. Staffing, we unfortunately, like so many other healthcare providers and businesses, because of the significant downturn in our patient volume and in our fundraising dollars, we did some layoffs in early April. And then another percentage of our staff is still on furlough through the end of June. And we're trying to figure out now how can we bring as many of those back? How can we get our patient volume to a point that it's stable enough to bring additional staff back? So we're still in that phase of understanding what the long-term future of the organization looks like. We are still losing, even with the layoffs and the furloughs, about $1 million a month. Again, not different than community healthcare providers in New York State have been hit hard.
Is there anything you're pushing for in the next coronavirus relief package in Congress that could help?
We are asking, our political supporters, and they have, our advocates in the Senate and in the House, ensured that in the next package, that the potential to expand the PPP program to organizations with greater than 500 employees. There are many nonprofit organizations in the country that are in that space that are eligible for no funding. So that is a piece that is included in the new package that's being debated by Congress now that we're hoping to get some sort of resolution by the middle of June.
Yeah. And then you said layoffs and furloughs. Can you give me numbers or percentages or roundabouts there, please?
Sure. We did do permanent layoffs of 15% of the staff across the state. And we furloughed another 15%.
When we spoke about a year ago, the merger, the Planned Parenthood Greater New York merger was proposed. It obviously happened. And so how are things in terms of the merger? Did it accomplish what it set out to accomplish? And, you know, kind of just looking back a year, what's happened, what's going to happen?
Well, I would say that it will accomplish what it set out to accomplish. I think that the five of us being together when this pandemic hit actually lifted all boats. Right, we were able to ensure, as a larger, more stable, more sustainable organization, we were able to ensure that every region of the state where we provide services had both access to telehealth and centers open for people to go to. I think with the five of us standing on our own, I don't know that we could have guaranteed that, given, again, the how strong we were hit financially. So I think the idea of protecting and then moving to expand services across the state is still very much alive and well.
Laura McQuaid is president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Greater New York. From Oscar So White to Me Too, the American film industry has been struggling to demonstrate its commitment to equality. Nowhere is that more clear than with the state of affairs for female directors. The latest study from the Annenberg Inclusion Initiative showed that male directors outnumbered women 20-1 in the top-grossing films of the last 13 years. But at the University of Southern California, in one of the nation's premier film schools, one student production is making waves. Kate Young has more.
White on set, please. Roll sound.
Speeding.
Rolling.
Scene 2, echo, take 1.
With a little set dressing, a speech therapy classroom on the University of Southern California campus has been transformed. Paper moons and stars hang from the ceiling, rugs and beanbags form a comfortable sitting area, and posters explaining the mechanics of speech are stuck to the walls.
Action!
I'm Hampus Horn. There was a star danced, and under that was I born. What you do about nothing?
Cut!
It's all work that's been done in service of the USC Cinema School's signature class, known even beyond the campus's gates as the 480. As the longest-running production class in the school's history, it's traditionally seen as a gateway to Hollywood. But this year is special. For the first time, one of the films produced in the class is being made entirely by a cast and crew of women and gender non-conforming students. And they're being led by their director, USC senior Ella Harris.
So this is my first time directing in this kind of capacity where like I'm leading a crew of more than like 3 people, basically.
The film is called Spit It Out, Margot. Fellow senior Miriam Sachs wrote the film screenplay and is pulling double duty as the crew's sound technician.
Look, it's super gay. It's about this girl. She's in love with her speech teacher and she has a stutter. And through the story, she kind of learns to accept herself and her way of speaking and accept her crush and her heart and the things that are going on with her, even though it's not perfect, even though it's messy. So,
action.
My name is Jacqueline. I don't really have a speech issue just here because my mom says I talk too much and no boy will ever want me.
Usually, there'd be no reason that a senior thesis film would attract attention. But this is the world-famous USC Cinematic Arts Program. George Lucas, Robert Zemeckis, and Ron Howard are just a few of the well-known directors who have passed through the school. It was founded in 1929 in partnership with the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, as in the Academy Awards. It's not a coincidence that the USC Film School has been connecting young directors to Hollywood for generations. But with the Me Too movement highlighting Hollywood's lack of female representation, an entire crew without men is getting a lot more attention. And Ella is very aware of the stakes.
I think it comes in different waves for different people. You know, we have one semester to make a 12-minute film. Ours happens to be a musical with 3 choreographed numbers. And there's a lot of moving parts. And so it's like we're doing that on top of making sure that it's in our style and it's in our voice, which takes its own set of work. And, you know, obviously we all want it to be something that we're proud of. So, yeah, I do feel the pressure.
The students making Spit It Out, Margot know that the deck has long been stacked against women. In the 91-year history of the Oscars, And not coincidentally, the school itself, only 5 women have ever received Best Director nominations, and only one actually went home with the Oscar.
Well, the time has come. Kathryn Bigelow!
This is the first Academy Award and second nomination tonight for Kathryn Bigelow.
1 Best Director in 9 decades. Women in the industry are fighting against history. It's one reason why some of the alumni of the cinema school try to stay in touch with current students like Ella. This is Ashley Maria, director of a documentary about sexism in Hollywood.
Pioneers and Skirts, we screened and then we had a panel afterwards. And so we asked Ella to be on it because it felt very much like she's going through something now that I went through. Exactly. The exact same assumptions placed on her and her team, and the exact same, are you sure? Can you do it? You know, are you capable? So I hope by me being there and going, you're not alone, she feels better and that her team feels better. I mean, that was our biggest message, is like, you are not alone.
The dismissive attitudes Ashley faced as a female filmmaker began cropping up while she was still at USC.
We didn't think anything of it. But then we had people joke with us because they were convinced we were going to be really catty and be hard to work with and difficult. And I will say, we were probably the most high-functioning group.
For Ashley, that problem continued after graduation. Despite a Directors Guild of America award, she hasn't found it any easier to get work in an industry dominated by men. And unfortunately, she's not alone.
Hi, my name is Nina Kramer. I'm a writer, director, and comedian. I went to USC, graduated in 2018, and now I'm directing full-time, acting full-time, and doing shows at night.
Nina's current gripe is that the industry standard for women is impossibly high. With the way things are right now, she says, there isn't any real room for women to find themselves artistically or grow in their craft.
Like, I want there to be more room in the industry right now for women to be mediocre, or for women to just be good and have the promise of being better and becoming great. Because right now we have this culture where it's either they're not good enough or they are the fucking best.
Until things change, succeeding in Hollywood means following an old industry dictum, fake it till you make it.
There's such a performance element to being in this industry and to being a creative player. You really have to like play a character almost and like navigate those spaces and kind of also demand that you be respected in those spaces. I find myself becoming a lot more mask when I'm around men, like, because I've learned that the more you assert yourself in those places, the less they question whether or not you should be there, because that's what men are doing too. Men will enter a space and they'll be like, I deserve to be in this space. I'm going to be in this space. And men will listen.
So Meg, same as for Austin, it'll be
straight in the camera.
Straight in the camera.
Back in the converted speech therapy classroom on the USC campus, everyone on set is united in their goal. Ella knows she's fortunate to lead a set like this.
You're doing great?
Yeah.
You're doing such a great job, Ella.
That's not what I asked for.
Let me validate you.
That's not what I meant. Stop it.
You rock.
Certainly when I was younger and working on sets, I would often be the only woman. Maybe there would be somebody in hair and makeup or script. And so it was rare to, you know, have colleagues that were women.
Director Brenda Goodman is Ella's supervising professor.
As time went on, that wasn't the case. I've worked with many women directors as a producer. I think what has struck me is the industry's belief that the stories that a lot of women want to tell are not the stories that greater audiences want to see. And we see that in how films are distributed, which films get made. We see that in the award shows, what films are chosen. Because I think that is changing. Women don't necessarily get rewarded for their leadership, for being in charge, for being bold. And in order to lead in this industry as a producer or a director, you have to own that power.
And so, you know, shadowing is great, programs are great, but really what women need
is just the job. Just give them the freaking job.
One small change? Lulu Wang's The Farewell won Best Feature at this year's Indie Spirit Awards.
There's been a lot of conversation this year about how to encourage more women to be in film or get more women into the conversation. And I just have to say that we don't have to encourage women. There are lots of women making films and who want to make films.
Can you say some of that end line to Grace?
Back at home, and cut off from the facilities available on campus, Ella worries that despite small signs of progress, the pipeline for women in the industry will be shut off once again, thanks to the COVID-19 global pandemic. With film production shut down across the world, producers will face hard decisions about what survives the industry's financial strain. After looking at the impact on her peers already in the industry, Ella believes that women will likely be the first casualties.
I am really sad to say this, but like part of me feels that like the initial push to give women this chance kind of was taken as like a failure because look, we didn't make it through production the first time, and who knows if she'll get that opportunity again. I think this was my opportunity, and it just sucks that like this happened during it, but I also feel that it is my responsibility to like act accordingly, and that means like rolling with the punches that come this way, and that just happens to be a global pandemic in the middle of the semester.
From Los Angeles, California, I'm Kate Young.
This story is part of an ongoing collaboration between PRX and the USC Annenberg School of Journalism in Los Angeles. Principal photography on Spit It Out Margot wrapped before LA's lockdown began. With post-production happening remotely, the fate of the film is still up in the air. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1612.